One of the people we turn to at The New Yorker to help sort out the lunacy and chaos of the world is staff writer James Surowiecki. He writes the Financial Page column, and the fallout from the Brexit vote has been keeping him pretty busy lately. One of the sources of information and context that he's got is Sony Kapoor, an economist based in London and the managing director of the international think tank Redefine.
We're going to talk about the implications of Brexit for Britain, but let's start by talking about the implications for Europe and perhaps even the global economy. In the immediate wake of Brexit, there was a pretty profound sense of panic in world markets. That has calmed down considerably. But what's your take on the broader implications of Brexit for, let's say, for the European economy?
I think it's important to put a corrective out there that a Brexit has not happened. And if things go according to the plans of a number of us involved in the policy discussion, and if the economy continues to hemorrhage as it is, and public opinion continues to shift, it is probably more than 50% likely that a Brexit may actually never happen. In terms of the shock from the Brexit vote, the pound has fallen, which means that the profit in the near term of UK-registered companies in British pounds will actually be higher.
So the weak pound is good for big British international companies, at least in the short term,
profitability will go up. But in the long term, the prognosis is almost surely negative. Yes.
Okay.
And on Europe, so there are two schools of thought, and the markets are trying to decide which one of these is the right one. One says that the UK being out of the EU will allow other countries, particularly Eurozone economies, to go ahead with further integration, which, as we have seen from the euro crisis, is necessary, but for which political will has been lacking. And in particular, the United Kingdom has been the most reluctant member of the school of thought that says we need more political union, we need more centralized governance mechanisms. So with the UK out, there are fewer obstacles to other countries actually integrating more. So that might actually be good for Europe.
So the idea is that the Eurozone, where those countries that share a common currency, one of the consistent problems they've had is that they have a common monetary policy, but they have very little, if any, common fiscal policy. So there's no way for political integration and fiscal integration does not match monetary integration, which creates all kinds of problems. And that's very different from what we have in the U.S., where we have a common currency and a common federal political system. And since Britain is not a member of the euro, but has been a member of the EU, its departure, in a sense, could allow the euro and the EU to become more closely aligned. That's the thesis, roughly speaking?
Absolutely. And with the United States, it took several decades, if not more than 100 years, to turn from a monetary union into a proper, full-functioning, federalized fiscal union that it is now. And we are trying to do in Europe that same thing over a far shorter time horizon. And rather than these being separate states within a single federal entity, these are separate countries. So in a way, the challenge in the Eurozone has been much bigger.
Right.
But it is true that countries are likely to go faster. The other good thing that has happened is that the economic panic and the political crisis unleashed by the Brexit vote has given voters in many of the countries where Euroscepticism has been growing, particularly the Netherlands, Denmark, and France, it has given voters a pause for thought. And polls just in the past week or so have shown a swing of 10 to 20% in public opinion towards remaining members of the European Union. And
that's because of the backlash, again, the sort of economic slash political backlash that we've seen in Britain since since the vote was taken?
I think that has sent a very powerful message. A country where there is no prime minister, the leaders of the OUT campaign have both gone, and the opposition is also in a state of total tatters, with the economy already looking down. That signal to voters in these countries that a vote to leave the European Union will mean massive economic and political carnage is a very strong signal to stay members. So I think that on the whole, apart from the direct negative impact of the UK going into a recession and the uncertainty associated with it, this is more likely to be a positive development for the rest of the Eurozone over the medium to longer term.
The pro-leave people, most notably Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, have tried to make the case that Britain will simply be able to, in effect, maintain its current trade relationship with the EU, but just do so while outside of the union. But I think others are much more skeptical that that would be possible. Can you talk a little bit about what you think the implications for trade between the EU and Britain are if Brexit were to occur?
So there are three aspects to this. The first is, if you look at it from the perspective of the European Union and other 27 member states, they have a very strong incentive to make sure that Britain gets a bad raw deal and is made to suffer. Politically, that is very important.
Because that then tells other Eurosceptics, if you leave,
this is it's disaster.
Look at how bad things
absolutely
are going to
be. Exactly. So some of that is already happening, and it's entirely self-inflicted by us in the UK. But in addition to that, over and above, there's a strong incentive to play it really tough. The second is the UK already has more exceptions than any other European Union member. We have had what is essentially a very sweet deal, where we have kind of cherry-picked certain exceptions. We never have to join the euro. We are not part of the Schengen area. We are not part of the common migration policy, particularly refugee policy, etc. So we have the best of both worlds, where we've benefited from being part of the single market while having stayed away from what is domestically politically contentious. And in that context, for then the UK to go and ask for further concessions, this has been totally awful. And our international reputation is in tatters. We have burned all our bridges. And frankly, we've been acting as spoiled brats, you know, like a bull in the china shop, not just damaging ourselves, but just breaking everything around us. And whatever comes to us in terms of, let's say, the EU playing hardball, it's entirely self-inflicted and very well deserved. The last point is the arrangements that are possible. The most likely being talked about is Norway. And I was a strategy advisor to the Norwegian government for a couple of years. And the deal with Norway is that Norway essentially has to pay more or less as much as the UK does on a per capita basis. Norway has to blindly accept almost every single piece of legislation and regulation that is to do with trade and commerce and goods and services. Norway has to be part of Schengen area, and Norway has to accept free movement of people from any other EU state. And these are the terms at which Norway gets access to the single market. And these terms will be unacceptable to those who have voted leave, because the primary driver has been the populist backlash against immigration, against free movement of people. And yet what is very clear is that we will not have access to the single market without free movement of people. So we are stuck in this dilemma of having to make an impossible choice, where at present, the deal we have, free movement in exchange for access to single market, is perfect, but we don't want this anymore. And we want the best of both worlds, which is politically impossible.
So as is very clear from this interview, and also is very clear from things you said before and wrote before the vote was taken, you view Brexit as, to use a soccer term, an incredible own goal, basically Britain inflicting enormous harm on itself. When you think about the victory for the Leave campaign, where do you think Remain failed? Where do you think the campaign to get Britain to stay in the EU failed? Why did Leave end up winning?
we have had a prime minister who has spent pretty much 6 years essentially insulting the EU, not having had a single positive word to say about Brussels or European institutions. And then in the past 6 months, he suddenly switches tack and becomes the lead campaigner for remaining inside the EU. And even then, he can scarcely get himself to say one positive thing about the European Union. All he can focus on is that there would be a disaster were we to leave. We know we don't particularly like it. It's an uneasy relationship, but the alternative is worse. And in terms of inspiring voters, in terms of emotional involvement, in terms of increasing turnout and having people believe in something positive, which given the austerity of the past few years, they desperately needed, the Remain campaign totally failed. It was an entirely negative campaign that couldn't simply bring itself to say anything positive about the European Union, which historically has now been the world's most successful peace and prosperity generating project, having successfully integrated the post-Soviet Central Eastern Europe economies and maintained peace in Europe for the first time, for the longest time in centuries. So we failed totally in our positive messaging, and we allowed the other side to promise motherhood and apple pie and the sky
right.
Without being able to dent their credibility. And the Leave side were emotionally vested. They were angry. They turned out in much larger numbers. So we are going to continue to discuss and debate this without the dust settling down for many years to come.
Thank you very much for talking with us today, Sony.
Thank you for having me.
Sony Kapoor is a macroeconomist and managing director of Redefine, a global economic think tank.
And that's The New Yorker's James Surowiecki.